we'd climb a tree, and maybe then we'd talk, or sit silently and listen to our thoughts.
Hello, kindred spirits. This is the History Chicks recap of the Netflix series And With an E, Episode 7, entitled Wherever You Are Is My Home, which is, as usual, a quote from Jane Eyre. And this one's from Chapter 22, if you're following along. Jane's been away for a month and runs into Mr. Rochester on the way home. And the entire quote is, he says, "Go up home and stay your little wandering feet at a friend's threshold." And she says, "Thank you for your great kindness. I'm strangely glad to get back again to you. And wherever you are is my home, my only home."
That's really sweet, even if you don't read the whole book. Just that one quote is really sweet.
Although it's weird because he still thinks he's going to get married to somebody else. It's very stressful about that time in the story. I think, as regards to our story here, Matthew to Anne.
Well, everybody to Green Gables.
Yeah, Matthew to Marilla, obviously. Mm-hmm. With a tiny touch, I'd say, of Gilbert and Anne, like an age-appropriate.
And how about Jeannie and Matthew?
Yeah, man, Matthew and everybody, huh?
I know, he's like the center spoke of the wheel, whatever that's called. The center of the spokes.
The hub?
The hub, yes. You think it's going around Anne, but in reality, it's going around Matthew. This episode was directed by Amanda Tapping. And you know what I love about this whole series is that they were different directors for every episode.
That's pretty common for a TV show.
Well, yeah. Yes, it is. It's only 7 episodes. I don't know. I just love that they had a different look a little bit for every single one. It's like having a bunch of different artists doing, the similar painting.
Ah, good.
Anyway, she was raised in Canada. She was an actress and a director for a very long time. she had acted and directed in Supernatural, which has a huge fandom, including my daughter. So that's pretty cool.
She's mostly known, though, as Samantha Carter on SG-1 and Stargate Atlantis, kind of 11 seasons worth of a mixed bag of that. And then 4 seasons as Dr. Helen Magnus on Sanctuary. So science fiction and fantasy seem to be her background as an actress. And as a director, you said Supernatural, yes, but also Continuum and Dark Matter and Travelers and a World War II Canadian action show called X Company. But do you see a lot of science fiction elements in this episode?
not really.
I mean, no. Amanda Tapping is thoroughly grounded in science fiction.
Well, it's universe creating, right? And Anne's universe is not our universe, so I guess in a stretchy kind of way, maybe.
That is really good.
Well, thank you. Wow, who knew no coffee would do this to me? Here's the Netflix description for this episode. With the future of Green Gables at stake and an ailing Matthew confined to bed, Anne and Marilla move mountains to save their home.
A surprisingly good Netflix synopsis. Usually they're not that brief.
Yeah, I thought so too.
So we open on the school, and Minnie Mae and her age group are singing Away in a Manger, the obviously it is getting ready for Christmas scenario, because I don't know that, you know, any other time there's a Christmas tree and people are singing Away in a Manger. You know what? Good assumption, right?
That's right.
Who is that lady? I'm going to guess the preacher's wife, because isn't that him sitting, I'm going to say sleeping over in the corner by the tree?
Yeah. Yeah, because we were discussing whether that was the church / school, remember?
I think it is.
Yeah, I do too.
Minnie Mae is freaking cute. Is she not freaking cute?
She is so cute.
And I'm very surprised that her mama let her out of the house with that messy of hair. I'm just telling you.
Maybe it was under her hat. Maybe it's hat hair.
Oh, you're right. I have a hat that's made of wool. And as I walk, it rubs on the back of my head and I end up with a giant pet sized rat on the back of my hair.
Mm.
So Anne and Moody Spurgeon McPherson are making snowflakes and talking at one table. Everyone's crafting. And Moody says, "Do you think it's true that no two snowflakes are alike?" And Anne has the cutest little line. "Well, I hope so. It's kind of comforting."
Yeah, they have quite the intellectual conversation going on at the snowflake crafting table.
But across the room, not that far across the room, they are less than, say, 10 feet apart. So Josie Pye is spreading gossip with Diana and Ruby and Jane, who are also doing some kind of crafting project, but mostly talking. And it seems, according to Josie, the Cuthberts are poor, she says. Interesting. Her uncle is the bank manager who should have the integrity to keep that crap to himself, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote pies, though. Pies. So over at the other table, Anne and Moody are talking. I mean, such a nice conversation they're having. I heard that snow is a sign of God's forgiveness, says Anne. She's shushed by the lady at the front, but she just, whatever. You can shush Anne all you want all day. She keeps going, it makes the ugly earth beautiful again. And then, of course, we go back to Josie. Poor, as in pitiful old fellow with no head for finance. I mean, that seems pretty hard. Like, whose fault is a shipwreck exactly, Josie Pye?
Yeah, really. She says something in there about the Cuthberts had to mortgage their farm. Isn't that sad? And there's this grin on her face. It was, speaking of Christmas, it kind of reminded me of the Grinch. You know, that grin the Grinch got?
I know, but get this. Ruby stands up for Anne to Josie and says, that's not very nice, which is a great bit of growth for Ruby, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Anne hears her all right this time. But she does not engage quite yet. Moody and Anne are discussing, Anne's never really had a real Christmas, but I plan to this year, says Anne. And then she kind of wonders, why did Father Christmas not stop at the orphanage? Huh, the matron probably scared him off.
Sure, that's it.
I think that whole scene is pretty cute. She eventually does get up and confront Josie Pye, and Jane Andrews is back, by the way, at the table. Where's she been? I don't know.
I don't know either. I wondered exactly the same thing. I'm like, isn't that? It took me a second. Oh, it's Jane. Where she's been.
I know. So evidently at this time, a mortgage equals pawn shop, I guess. This is my reading of it, because nowadays that's sort of just standard practice. If someone revealed to you that someone had a mortgage on their house, you'd be like, okay. It would be more shocking to hear that they didn't have one, like enviable that they didn't have one.
Right.
Well, anyway, Anne's had it. That is a dirty word or whatever. And Anne goes up there and confronts Josie. And Josie's answer is, why are you upset? It's only true. You're poor. And then she said, wait, you didn't know? She's horrible.
Oh, she is. She just knows which buttons to push, and she just jams her finger right on them.
And then she sets off the ricochet. She knows what to do. Do you at least know if they're going to keep you?
That's the big button on Anne's head right there.
How do some people have the ability to get you right in the heart? I mean, practice, I guess, in her case.
I think that's what they're looking for. Mm. They're looking for ways to feel superior to somebody. So they are always, they're keenly in tune to find their, you know, their weak points.
Well, Josie has set off a chain of feelings and thoughts in Anne. So we've got another invisible flashback is what I'm guessing. So her biggest insecurity, Anne, raises its ugly head again. Hello. Hello, it's me. Ah, you know, the preacher's wife, I wish I knew her name because I hate to call her that, Mrs. Preacher, calls up the next class, and the girls and Moody need to practice their song. And where are the rest of the big boys? We know that Gilbert's just out of the picture, but Billy and friends and Charlie Sloan? There's not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And it's not like it's crop season where they need to be doing stuff at home.
This kind of makes me think that this might just be kind of a volunteer Saturday. And that's why everybody can just walk around and leave and talk. And there's no, I just think it's not a official event.
Oh, now that you say that, I don't recall seeing Mr. Phillips.
Anyway, Anne is obviously lost in thought while she attempts to sing at the beginning. You know, watch during the singing, by the way, Diana's face over on the right is as placid as can be. And it is Ruby who keeps looking at Anne with a worried face. You guys.
I know. Well, we saw her flip over to Team Anne not that long ago.
And it's maybe because she's lived in their house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, once people become people, you know, she's able to relate to them. They're not just, you know, the poor, weird Cuthberts. The same thing with what we do, you know, and our regular thing, our historical women. We get to know them and they're not just one dimensional. So they're not one-dimensional for Ruby anymore.
Oh, that's right. Okay, okay. Well, we have a photo moment here. The camera zooms in on Anne's face. She has stopped singing. And you know, when you're obsessing about something, you just have to take action. She's got to get an answer. She has to go home. She has to go home right now.
Yeah. You know, I'm calling that the Anne shot because it's like on all the advertising posters. It's kind of a head and shoulders of Anne with something fuzzy in the background. But you just are just drawn to her face and her freckles and her eyes and her different expressions. They do that shot a lot. I don't know what they call it, but I'm calling it the Anne shot. This time, the Anne shot, she had a look of, you know, confusion and terror in her face.
So you see Diana and Anne walking home and they're talking. Anne's very worried, of course, about her family's future. It can't be true. And then Diana says, it isn't. That Josie Pye is just as mean as they make him. And then Anne mourns, my first family, my first home. And Diana reaches for her hand after she says, my first home. It's very touching.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to send you back. You're in the Bible and everything, she says.
I love that line. You're in the Bible and everything.
And I was wondering if there's any fashion historians in the audience. How do the gaiters stay up?
Oh, good question. I just assumed that they were that thick boiled wool. So they just kind of stood up on their own. But maybe they're canvas, like a real stiff. I don't know. Good question. I'd like to know, too.
Anyway, Marilla's voice, we hear just before we see her, she is freaking out because Matthew took a mortgage out on the farm. She says, you mortgage the farm? Are you out of your mind? And we come to Anne outside, kind of going from door to window, listening. So they do have a secret audience, but they don't realize it. Marilla is shocked that he took such a step without discussing it with her. And Matthew is defending what he did. You know, we'll get caught up. The crop was lost. We didn't have means, which he didn't tell her that either, evidently, that the crop was lost. She doesn't even know that.
Mm-mm.
Oh, my gosh.
And I know. She is so mad.
She says, you didn't trust me to talk about our future and Anne's. She's very afraid. She's very afraid. And don't forget, this is the man who bought just 2 pairs of extra boots once, remember, and Marilla made him return them. So what is she going to do with house money? I mean, that's why Matthew wants it kept secret, his whole plan. He actually puts his foot down. We have the loan. That's done. And I was thinking, you know what? You can always just walk that money back over to Mr. Pye's bank. Maybe Marilla is too. But Matthew has prevented her from making him do that by having spent all the money.
All of it. He's buying some seeds for high-yield crops, although we never know exactly what they are. And he feels that those new crops with the potatoes will get them solvent again in the spring. He's got a plan. I know.
I call that debt justification. If this and this happens and this comes in, we'll be fine. I mean, you know, debt used to be a lot more shameful, especially at this level. But it's kind of funny because during the last episode, there was a reference made to a very common experience of debt, which is running a tab at the general store.
Oh,
with a farm community, merchants, even in America, even a lot later than this, were completely content with running a tab, knowing that farmers get all their money kind of in a lump sum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an acceptable kind of credit. But then this kind of credit where you put your house at risk, that seems to be shameful to everyone.
Yeah, everyone involved, except Matthew felt like he had, remember him in the last episode, he was just going, he was frantic. He had no other options as far as he was concerned.
Well, this is the only time I've ever seen Matthew lose his crap. And he screams, why can't you just listen? And Marilla sums it up for us. I don't 100% know that we needed this, but she says, so at your age, you're going to work harder. I don't want you doing more. I want you doing less. To which Matthew drops like a sack of potatoes.
I don't know. That was like the fastest change of plans in the history of anything. And can you imagine having said that and then it happened? Poor Marilla.
And I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Foley artist just literally dropped a sack of potatoes for real.
Oh, yeah, I know.
That's what it sounds like.
It does. He was a little bit grabbing his chest, but not like before he was. You could tell he was getting worked up, but not like we've seen him grab his chest before. He wasn't really doing much of that. So this whole big episode is kind of a surprise to you know, if Marilla had seen him doing that, she might have backed off a little bit or something, but nope.
Well, Anne runs in. She's blown her cover. They are both freaking out, screaming at each other. What's happening? Blah, 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 blah. It's the height of great distress. And then the happy opening credits begin.
I have absolutely nothing to say here. I usually do. I've been fast forwarding through them the last couple, but I just want to thank Moira Wally Beckett, Brad Kunkel, and the Tragically Hip for this beautiful opening.
Okay, so I do have something. I idly Googled a random name from the credits.
Okay. Oh, good.
Miranda DePonsier, who is a producer, get this, was Josie Pye in the 1985 Anne of Green Gables.
Shut up. Well, oh my gosh. So she's a producer on this one?
Uh-huh. On all of them.
Wow.
I know. It's so good. That was a good name to pick. So the doctor's at Green Gables and Matthew is, I think, unconscious, but maybe asleep. The doctor says he's had an episode of the heart and he's in a dangerous position. He is to have no stress and no work for months, the doctor says. Months means spring, which means planting, which means all the work required to get those crops that you bought the seeds for that you need to pay back the loan.
Mm-hmm. It was a heart attack. I mean, well, he says it's an occurrence of coronary thrombosis.
Yeah.
Which is a fancy way for saying it was a blockage of the artery going to the heart, or otherwise known as a heart attack.
That quilt, incidentally, looks like mine. My punk rock Victorian crazy quilts. My favorite ever. They are so heavy, those blankets. Like that 25-pound blanket they're selling now for comfort, for anxiety release. Mm-hmm. These country women were onto something. So I hope that's helping Matthew.
Yeah, I hope so too. Hey, can I just comment on how well those oil lamps brighten a room? I mean, they're very liberal with them in this house. They put a lot out, so it's always very well lit. But I was just, do you have any at your house?
Yeah, I do have some. I don't have oil in them. But yeah, we have Chris Graham's great grandma's oil lamps.
Well, I see them at, like, you know, antique shops or, you know, vintagey resale shops.
Oil lamps get dirty and you literally have to clean them all the time because the soot builds up on those hurricanes. I mean, even during one use, if you don't take off that chimney and clean it, and you can reduce your light by like half.
Wow, they must clean them a lot at the Cuthberts. It just fascinated me that it was so well lit. And so I kept looking to see how many oil lamps they had going. And there's a lot. No wonder Marilla is always so busy. I mean, she goes top to bottom on that house every day, plus cleaning all those oil lamps. I did learn something very interesting.
Okay.
A gallon of oil will create 140 plus hours of light.
You know, the same thing could be said, and I guess Crisco is oil. They always tell you to put a big container of Crisco in your emergency kit. It'll burn for a long time if you put a wick in it, or you could eat it in an emergency, or you can use it as lotion.
Well, I was reading this article and it said you can use any kind of oil. It's just that they'll smell.
You know, in Jane Austen, they're talking about beeswax candles. Mm-hmm. Because those would smell nice, but most people use tallow candles, which basically made your house smell like a butcher shop, I guess.
That was a plot line in Victoria.
Oh, well, there you go.
They went around and changed all the candles from beeswax to save money, and the whole place stunk.
Was it really? I guess I didn't see that. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Later, downstairs, Marilla is poring over the ledger books. She's looking for some kind of either solution or details. We don't know what she's doing. There's a lot of light going on. there's more than one lamp on the table, for one thing, plus legions of candles on the right of Marilla. Anne comes downstairs with another oil lamp and says, "You should be asleep." And Marilla says, "So should you." Anne comes to sit down and they do a little leaning type of hug, kind of affectionate. And I think it's really good that Marilla's not keeping secrets from Anne. She's treating her like a person.
Oh, yeah. And a member of the family. They're in this together. And that little scene right there at the table, it just shows it. It illustrates it. You know, one of the things that interested me, Marilla is still dressed. She's not in her nightclothes. So she hasn't gone to bed yet at all.
Right.
Like, she didn't get up because she was worried about it. You know, you do that sometimes. You try to, I'll just go to sleep and I'll feel better in the morning and I'll be able to look at it with fresh eyes. But she didn't even try that. She's still been up the whole time.
I know. And she says to Anne, "I wish I had a head for numbers." I think she was pulled out of school early also, by the way. And Anne, this is the pretty much nearly only book accurate thing Anne says, I'm a dunce at geometry, but I'm pretty good at math now.
Oh, yeah.
So Marilla watches Anne do the math, and what you've got going is high interest plus short repayment schedule, which is not good. Proto-predatory lending, which makes me wonder if Josie Pye's uncle was gloating about this, and that's how his family knows, you know?
Oh, probably. I wanted to know how Anne knew what a high rate of interest was, like a number.
The magic of narrative economy.
I know. And then Marilla says, I have to go speak to the bank. I need some clarity. It's like, oh, be careful what you wish for there, Marilla.
Anne says that she's going to, wait for it, even if Marilla isn't keeping her. That shocked Marilla into a little bit of forgetfulness about the ledger. She looked at her and she's so surprised that Anne was thinking this. And she says, you're a Cuthbert. For better or worse. And then she makes a little joke. No getting out of it now. And is it an accident that she uses the language of vows? I mean, that she knows that, you know, for better or for worse, that's very Anne speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it works magic on Anne. Magic. Whose worry is just wiped away.
So that's how easy it is to get Josie Pye out of your head, Anne.
So Anne wants to go to the bank, and it seems like she wants to protect Marilla from further trickery, kind of, I guess. You know, if you're no good with numbers and you're in a sphere you're uncomfortable in, she does say, I know for a fact that when one is under stress, it's hard to hear what's being said. So every fugue state we've ever seen is a callback to that, which is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is a way of saying, you know, I will listen also. Together we can handle this, kind of. It was really good.
Yeah, I think that's what that whole table scene was about, is how they were a team.
In the daytime, the next day, Anne is kissing Matthew goodbye on the forehead. You know what that means, kids. It means love. She and Marilla are headed to the bank, and Rachel is going to watch over him. Rachel's a good friend.
So I was like, is he still asleep, or did he wake up and go to sleep again, or is he unconscious? Would they leave him like that without a doctor? I mean, I guess so, because there's no hospital.
I don't know what Rachel could do if he had a crisis. You know, really, though, think about it. We've covered doctors of this period. What could a doctor even do?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So we're outside the bank, which, in fact, I thought was a train station.
You did? Why?
Banks need to look more banky. To me.
Banky.
Well, of course I read the sign, but no, when you open, it's a white building with green trim and it looks like a train station to me.
Okay.
But of course the sign does say Bank of Carmody, established 1847. The name of the president is not Pye, it's Robert Shore. So maybe he's a married in Pye, I guess, which is even worse because he had to choose to be a dirtbag. And I did write, I like his typewriter though.
Well, I have to say, Robert B. Shore, president. How about Bobby Shore, series cinematographer?
Good. Very Pixar.
I was so pleased with myself.
Well, so Marilla and Anne are inside, and they meet with a banker who, the lightest thing I can say about him is that he's not very charming. He is irritated about the irregularity of speaking to women. I think.
Yeah.
He demands to know where Mr. Cuthbert is before he even explains to Marilla. And Marilla, kind of makes a fateful revelation to him. She tentatively asks to renegotiate not the amount of the loan, but the schedule of repayment. So when Marilla explains the health situation of her brother, he has had a heart attack. Evidently, the loan is now considered a high-risk investment because Matthew himself and the work that he was going to put into the crops to repay the bank's investment. Well, that's now at risk. And Matthew had signed a document with a clause in it that allowed the bank to pull the loan back, is how he puts it. Mm-hmm. They can call in the debt in a 30-day period. The investment must be returned or the property forfeit. So either they come up with that money or the bank gets Green Gables in 30 days, which is the worst possible news that Marilla and Anne could possibly have gotten.
He was horrible. He's like, at the beginning, he's like, this is just irregular. You know, you said it. He's like, it's irregular. But he kept like repeating it. Where is Mr. Cuthbert? Okay, he's not here. You can talk to us.
At first, I was all like, they should have kept his condition on the DL. But first, you know, how were they supposed to know?
Mm-hmm.
And second, who's watching him right now? The Human Telegraph of PEI, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Mrs. Lynn knows. Everybody knows. She won't mean to be mean, but the whole universe is going to know that Matthew's had a heart attack if they don't already.
Yeah. She just needed to go to the bank for some clarity. There's your clarity.
So they're in shock. They're walking outside. Marilla gets some kind of thought and goes off on an errand. We don't know what yet. And Anne spots La Rue Aubert, the fancy dress shop, and is looking happily in the window. And we get a little photographic shot of Anne in the window. And then the next thing we see is that Marilla is buying an ad. Either she's at the telegraph office sending a telegraph to the paper, or she's actually at the newspaper office. We were kind of debating about that.
Well, there's a little printing press, a very small one, and it's doing single sheets of paper.
Okay.
It's printing it off. And there's, you know, typeset letters everywhere. So that's why I thought it might be the paper office. But the paper is actually, like, you know, our newspapers. It's not just one sheet. So, you know, maybe they did all kinds of printing. You know, these places have to be multi-purpose. But she had 36 letters total in her ad.
By the way, she didn't have 36 letters, but we'll talk about that later. So they get back to Green Gables, and Rachel gives the Matthew report. He's sleeping nicely. He's been calm, and she wonders how it went at the bank. And obviously, you know, ruination, the worst ever. We're going to lose Green Gables. And Rachel offers to rally the troops in town, which I think she should let her do. The Cuthberts will not accept charity, says Marilla. Okay, I have to say, is this not just another kind of burning house?
Yeah.
They have paid up on karma. They have shown up for how many burning houses through the years? The least anyone can do is to pour water on this problem, don't you think?
I do. Although if you've been trained to believe that being good and being Christian means helping your neighbor, it doesn't mean asking for help. So you've been giving your whole life. So it also says that the people she's been giving to, she feels are in far worse condition than she ever could be. It shows her prejudice, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
She feels like it lowers her.
Mm-hmm. It lowers her. That's the prejudice right there. She believes that the receiver is in a lower position than she is. The receiver is the lesser of the two. The giver is the greater.
And she's not willing to be the lesser.
Correct.
Temporarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they make a plan, some plans. Valuables all have to go. The Berries will buy the cows. Jerry has to be let go. And Marilla just goes right outside to let him go. It's a photo moment. Anne has her back to the door, and you see the firing out the window in the backyard.
Oh, I know. So sad. He just, like, hangs his head. Oh, poor Jerry.
Later, Anne is sitting there looking at all the things, the valuables that have to be hauled out to sell. Matthew has evidently said the pawnbroker in Charlottetown buys all sorts of goods, you know, from when he had to sell his watch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting all this stuff together to take to him. The bird she was admiring that first day when she had to go see Mrs. Spencer to be sent back is mm-hmm. in there. It's quite an array of treasures, says Anne. And something very sad, very sad. Marilla is holding her pin, her amethyst pin that caused such distress, speaking of being sent back. And she's saying goodbye to it. And just the shot of her hands squeezing it before she wraps it up made me feel very, very sad.
Yeah.
And remember, it has a piece of her mother's hair in it.
I know. Ugh, that one must have hurt. I mean, the whole room looks like a garage sale, right? It's all these unrelated tchotchkes all over the tables. And that's the valuables that they had. But man, that it's like she was physically ready to give everything up. But emotionally, I don't know if she was ready. Mm.
Anne says, I wish I had something of value to contribute. And then she remembers she does. And she brings the dress down, the green dress. Speaking of letting go of emotional things, but Anne is not conflicted at all.
Nope.
So they're staying, evidently, with Miss Josephine. And they say in the manse, which is usually the pastor's house. So I don't get the use of that word manse. I think it was a mistake.
Oh, you thought they were maybe trying to say mansion in like a cool way.
So okay. I don't know. I think that was a mistake. Anyway, now Marilla has decided that she cannot leave Matthew for that long and they won't let her go alone. So remember, it used to be fine to just fling her on the back of a fish truck.
That's right.
Oh, how times have changed. So she's already arranged it. Jerry's going to go with Anne, despite her protest that she doesn't need a chaperone, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't want Jerry to go. And
part of her protest is that she Anne is insisting that it's the quintessential hero's journey.
Even more reason to send someone else. But really, Jerry was kind of a weird choice. Like, wouldn't Mr. Lind be better? I don't know. Unless Marilla wants to keep it on the DL. I guess you wouldn't want to involve that family at all.
And Jerry is essentially family.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so Anne and Jerry are packing up the sleigh, and Anne is trying her wiles to get Jerry to stay at home. You know, he is 100% not even going to let her. He is very protective, even though she is very antagonistic. He says, "You've been lucky." She says, "I've been smart." And he goes, "So then both, whatever."
Right. For a while, I had to play that over and over because I thought he said, "Then vote."
Oh, no.
But no, he didn't. He said, "Then both."
So then Diana and Anne have a really good, quiet agreement to keep that mirror and brush that Diana has brought, a silver-backed, I mean, it's a pretty valuable item. Mm. Diana brings it to give her to contribute to the cause. They keep it a secret in case Marilla refuses it. Diana even puts her hands back in her fur muff, like, la, 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 nothing to see, just saying goodbye.
So did Anne tell Diana? Probably, because they're best friends. They tell each other everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she probably did say, oh, yeah, Marilla's not taking any charity. Maybe Diana's family had offered something. I don't know. When Anne says goodbye to Marilla, she kisses her on the cheek. And again, Marilla looks like, oh, my goodness, I'm still not familiar with this motherhood feeling. And as Anne and Jerry are driving off, she just gently touches where Anne kissed her on the cheek. It was a very sweet, very quick moment.
Aw. So Marilla sends them off, two 13-year-olds. Going to the big city. I don't know. They're supposed to be at Aunt Josephine's by night. Jerry is, you know, he can't let her go. It's okay to ask for help sometimes, he says to her. And she says, if I needed it, I would ask for it. You wouldn't. I would. I would times infinity. I wrote, I'm glad I only have one child.
I wrote typical sibling behavior. But they are totally like brother and sister. I keep saying it. They're brother and sister. And that little, you know, time would times infinity. Although Jerry doesn't know what infinity means. Okay?
She says, no talking. So he starts to sing. And I am loving it so much. Jerry, you are a part of my heart. They are both. Anne and Jerry are so perfect. And he sings this song, and it's called Il était une bergère. And it is about a shepherdess watching her sheep. Now, it's got this advantage of being very long, like a proper road trip song. I mean, a lot of verses. So functionally, what he's singing is 99 bottles of beer on the wall, 99 bottles of beer. That is literally what he's singing.
That's right.
And he loves messing with her. The look on his face as she keeps protesting. Oh, yeah. My.
It's just hysterical. It's like he can't contain the smile. I don't know if that was natural because the scene was so funny and so realistic. I mean, that's my kids right there, you know. Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Fine. I won't touch you. I'll just lay on you, you know.
Oh, my God. Do they do the thing like, I'm not touching you? Where they have their hands. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Even now. My oldest is 20.
If people tried that, I would just punch them. I'm like, look, you, I'm going to get punished anyway. I'm going to, like, go ahead and prepay.
I'm going to go down fighting.
So the first stop is bring back the puffy-sleeved dress to La Rue Aubert. Huh. Anne goes into the shop, and Jeannie says, I see you've been here before. And Anne says, only in my dreams, which is... I mean, that's a way to make a shopkeeper like you from the beginning. Yeah. I need to return this dress, says Anne. And Jeannie's a little confused. Is there something wrong with it? Oh, no. Oh, no. Do you not like it? Says Jeannie. And she says, no, it is my very favorite thing that I have ever possessed in life. But I need to return it to help my family. Jeannie knows what dress this is. And she says, you're Matthew's Anne. And Anne says, how nice it is to hear it said that way.
Yeah. Well, she is so proud of being able to contribute like this. I mean, this is her dream dress, but maybe just getting it and knowing that she was cared for so much that they went out of their way to get it for her was enough.
Right.
It's almost right now like she's very proud to be able to do this.
Miss Jeannie obviously is told off camera. There's a little scene where Jerry sneaks up and looks in the window. And I think that's just so we don't have to hear the recounting of the story we already know. That was very clever. And so Miss Jeannie empties the till for Matthew. At first, like a fourth of it. And then she just grabs everything in there. See, people really do want to help.
Mm-hmm.
Marilla won't ask for help. Anne tells Jerry she won't ask for help. But man, you give people 5 seconds to help you and they will give you everything they have. Is that something else if they love you?
Mm-hmm. It was like not even like a second that she decided to grab all the money.
So good. So good. So back at Green Gables, Marilla is reading some scripture to Matthew. We go to a happier scene. I know it's kind of sad. It's supposed to be sad. But I think in comparison to the scene we just saw, there is some comedy that I can hardly stand for laughing. Anne says to the horse, "I hate to say goodbye." And Jerry says, "I won't be so long." And she says, "The horse, Jerry, why are you so annoying?"
Oh, they are so typical.
Why are they so adorable? Okay.
Wally Beckett must have had siblings.
Or children. I don't know.
Yeah. Yep.
So Anne is at the pawn shop and the owner, who looks so much like Joe Pesci in Home Alone, I can hardly even think of him as a different person.
Oh my gosh, you are absolutely correct.
He even acts like him, like, "Oh, you've been entrusted, have you?"
Oh, yeah. So very good.
Are you home alone? You know, like, come on. Okay, so Anne spins some yarns about the value of the items, which honestly, he puts his hand up in the air like, "Haven't heard that before. Oh, really? Ha ha. Letters from the Tsar, the Queen Victoria vanity set, the Prince Albert pen." And, you know, she rolls out the spying for the Queen, which he calls a crock because it is. And then he kind of looks at her in admiration and says, "What a piece of work you are." And he kind of likes the tall tales, even though he sees through them. She says the cutest thing, "After all the trouble we took to dress me in humble clothing." And then she says of one thing that she says is the Prince Albert pen, "If you can't afford it, I'll completely understand." And then suddenly he sort of 1/20th believes her.
Yeah, I think that's when she closed the deal right there. Like, he was kind of playing along. But she, you know, she was adding all these details, you know, about the Boer War and, you know, the espionage. She couldn't tell him anymore. "I can't believe I'm telling you all this." You know, she says, there's just enough detail in there that he's starting to crack a little bit.
Okay. These are the stories I could tell the people that come in here to buy this stuff, right? These are good stories. I'm going to write these down. So we are back at the school. And Rachel bursts in. Woo, she's taking charge. She is the boss. They are setting up for the Christmas pageant. And she just, right away, move that manger. No, here, no, here, no, here. And I have an Easter egg for you right now.
Okay.
The poor woman who is trying to simply do a volunteer job, and some lady comes bursting in and tells her what to do, to tell her to move the manger here and there. There's no real reason you should recognize that lady, necessarily, who's having to move the manger. But guess who it is?
Oh my gosh, it's Moira Wally Beckett.
It is the creator of Anne with an E. And on her Twitter account, she says that the only reason she's there is that a background player neglected to show up.
That's awesome. That was fantastic. Good spotting. Wow.
So anyway, now you know what Moira Wally Beckett looks like. So that's good. Mrs. Lynde is making plans to collect money for townsfolk that have lost money when the Adele Marie went down. Mrs. Lynde points out that the Cuthberts are particular victims of this ship. They've been hit very hard. And the ladies say, "I don't really know them. Do you know them?" And Mrs. Lynde turns, and in a photo moment with the plaster baby Jesus, she says, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels."
She's got her scripture memorized.
And in the spirit of Christmas, "I know everyone," and she gives everyone the eye. She doesn't actually point two fingers at her own eyes and points at them because her hands are full of Jesus. But that's what she means. "I'm sure everyone will be moved by generosity." And she reminds me so much of Kathy Bates' portrayal of Molly Brown in the Titanic movie right here.
Oh, totally. She's even got the outfit on. She's got like this fur hat and this cape that is architecturally quite complicated. She had just powered into the room. I mean, when you move the cradle, you're in charge. You know, that's like the biggie. Whoever puts Jesus in the manger scene there, that's like a super important job. And she just did it. Totally Molly Brown.
It's not the show, though. She's just setting up the props.
I understand that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a big deal. You putting the star on the top of the tree and putting Jesus in the manger is a big deal.
Jerry, back in town, is selling the horse. He's found a willing buyer. He's getting paid for it. While these two kind of smarmy ne'er-do-wells watch him put his money in his pocket, I have to tell you, they were not very discreet about handing over a large wad of cash in the middle of the street. I guess it's the confidence of being men. I don't really know. But anyway, Jerry openly puts money in his pocket and then heads down a deserted alley.
Oops.
So I don't know why he went down the alley. It's the middle of the day, I guess. It's maybe the false sense of security, but he gets the stuffing kicked out of him, doesn't he?
I was screaming at the TV. I'm like, no, not Jerry, not the face. No, no.
They take his money, these two ruffians, and they leave him, I mean, really, for dead. He could die lying face down in the snow if he doesn't wake up and nobody finds him. It's not a joke.
Mm-mm. Nope.
So you can see through the store window. That's where the camera is looking in. Anne is getting paid by the pawn shop owner. And it's kind of obvious who has won because he pays her one thing and she looks at him hard and he gives her some more money. So I love that. I'm glad the stories are working, whether he believes them or not. I'm glad that her personality has won him over anyway. And who is looking in the window with us? It's Gilbert. Who is looking in the window with us? It's Gilbert. We thought he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So Anne comes out of the store and she's happy to see him. And he is completely confused to see her in the pawn shop. He's not confused to see her necessarily, but he is completely at a loss as to why she would be in there selling things. He saw her get money, so he knows she's not looking around for a cool something or other for a birthday present. No, she's been selling things and he saw it. Do you remember those soaring feelings from the last episode? We discovered he was gone right at the moment when the string music is epic and it's the music of love. And then we get crashing down when we realize Gilbert is gone. Those feelings have been unresolved since we saw that episode.
I got something to say here.
Okay.
Do you remember when we were doling out raspberry cordials? I cut some because of I knew what was going to happen in this episode. This didn't even work for me. I'm so sorry. I loved it once I got on board. But in retrospect, and if I think about it, what are the chances that he would see her if they were in the same town? Why is Gilbert, he was, you know, he's a smart guy. He is working on the docks.
I can actually explain that. He explains it to you.
I know. He wants to travel. I get it. But how is he surviving?
I mean, I would guess he's probably more like a messenger boy. Like, go do these errands, go do this errands, go to town. He might work for a chandler's office.
He's got a box of tools.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe he's been going to go get the tools. I think he's more of an errand boy than anything. He's earning his passage.
Okay. I just think it's just all a little too coincidental for my taste. And I'm generally all about, you know, stretches. I can usually grasp them, but I just had such a hard time with this one. I love that they ran into each other and I love how this is going to play out, but the fact that they were both there at the same time, it was just a little too much for me.
Okay. Well, I didn't think this was as much of a stretch because Charlottetown's where the ports are,
mm-hmm.
and it's where the pawn shop is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that there is more than one commercial street. So it's not as much of a stretch as something that happens later in this show that I really don't like.
Oh.
Well, I'll accept this one. Susan does not accept this one, so.
But I liked it, and I'm not going to take points off on this episode. I already took them off.
So Gilbert invites her to go for coffee, and he takes her elbow to help her.
I know. That was so tender.
They go to the coffee house, and I know, Susan, that you really like the environment there.
Well, it's actually a pub.
But a pub in English and in Canadian terminology is not the same thing as a bar here. It's like children can be taken to the pub.
Right. No, I get it. It's a pub. They're going to the pub. Cool. Yes, I do love the atmosphere there. I thought it was I thought it was kind of nice. I'd like to hang out there, actually.
It looks like this place in Brooklyn that you will never believe the name of it. And I swear it's true. When I last went to New York with my friend Tina, we stopped off at a place called The Rabbit Hole.
Shut up.
And it looks a lot like this pub.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'll send you some pictures. So Gilbert explains what he's doing at the dock. He wants to see some of the world. He feels very badly about what happened with Matthew and says about Matthew, "I don't know what I would do if," which of course brings up the old issue, and she apologizes to him very sincerely. And she says, "I'm so sorry I wasn't more sensitive about your father. I know so much more now than I did then."
Yeah. This whole conversation, they sound like, you know, two millennials at Starbucks, kind of. "How's the job? What about the farm? You know, oh, I want to go see some of the world, you know, experience life." They just don't sound like two, you know, 13 and 15 year olds.
Well, they do, though. I think they both have so much weight on them that they've had to kind of grow up a little bit. And I was also kind of thinking about, you know, sure, they're young, but I often think we as grownups don't give kids and teenagers enough credit for really having kind of deep and grown up emotional feelings about things. This conversation is something else. He graciously forgives her. He says, in a nod to a scene we never get in season one, "That's all water under the bridge," he says.
I loved that. I was like, oh yeah, where's the bridge? I liked it when he said, he's talking about seeing some of the world first. He says, "If I come back to Avonlea, I want it to be a choice, not an obligation," which is what Marilla had told him at the cemetery. Remember, he was like, that was his moment when he had clarity and he knew what he was going to do when she said that. And that's it right there.
I know. So her words really did have an effect on his life. So while they're talking, a couple more customers come in, and there's no reason that either Anne or Gilbert would take notice of two additional customers entering the coffee store. They're just like everyone else, but we know from the fourth wall that it's the two robbers from before. The robbers are looking through the paper, the classifieds, and so they find an ad among a whole series of other ads. But the ad is not 36 words, by the way. It says, "Rooms to let, two rooms with meals, Green Gables, Avonlea, by mail to M. Cuthbert, December 2nd. That is 17 words. And also, one of them says, "Nice." Okay, so why is that nice? Why is that perfect? I don't get it. There's a whole bunch of other ads for rooms to let on that page.
Yeah, maybe the location, maybe just putting M. Cuthbert indicates, as it would to me, that it's a woman that's running the ad and doesn't want to put a man's name in. I don't know, but I tell you what, I did take a screenshot of that and I'll put it in the show notes. So if you want to look for any other Easter eggs in all those ads, I'm sure there's some in there. I just didn't stop to look at them.
On the street outside, Gilbert and Anne have a little moment, kind of awkward, like, how do you say goodbye? I don't know. And they have a cute little spelling bee. T-R-U-C-E is the word. And Gilbert makes another little joke. Moody would have gotten that wrong. Ha ha, yes, he would. Poor Moody. Bad handwriting and also a bad speller. Let's hope he comes into some money. So you have to love little Jerry, man. He just got the crap kicked out of him by these two grown men and froze his face off in the snow. And yet he rounds the corner and sees a strange guy talking to Anne and has no fear rushing in to save her. He is ready to kick Gilbert's A.
Get away from her. I thought that was very familial.
So Jerry, who is visibly messed up, there's blood all over the place. He keeps saying, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. They took all the money." So Gilbert's taking that in, too. That they're in a bad pickle. Gosh, it's bad. And he doesn't like the city, he says mournfully.
Yeah, I don't like the city. I don't like the city.
Inside the restaurant, the two ne'er-do-wells, the two robbers, okay, they catch sight of Jerry outside, talking with Anne and Gilbert. And they kind of like, don't turn around. So the one guy doesn't turn around and the other guy kind of snakes underneath the newspaper. In which case, I saw the boat's name is actually the Dalmarie and not Adele Marie. So sorry about that.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. The D-O-L-L?
No, D-A-L.
Oh, the Dalmarie.
The Dalmarie is a place in Haiti. I don't know if it has any bearing on the name of the boat.
Okay. Well, the two guys can't see Anne. I mean, they only see a girl with braids because her back is to them.
Right, right.
All they can see is, you know, Gilbert, who's just standing, so he could be any guy. So they're probably not even paying attention to him. And Jerry, who they're probably, you know, the guy behind the newspaper is peeking over, trying to keep an eye on Jerry, hoping he doesn't come inside the pub.
Right, right. Well, outside, we can now hear their conversation. Jerry recognizes Gilbert. He says, I remember you from the fire. And it's time to say goodbye to Gilbert. And Anne tells him to take care of himself and come home someday. And then they hold each other's eyes kind of longer than Jerry's comfortable with it. He keeps looking from one to the other. It's making me laugh. He doesn't look jealous. He looks more like, really, with this? What are you doing? This,
can we call this eye flirting?
No.
Oh.
I mean, you can call whatever you want.
Well, there's like some electricity going back and forth. Or was that just me?
No, there is. I think eye flirting would be what Ruby Gillis does.
Oh, that's so fake. This is like the real deal. I mean, at some point, you're going to be flirting with somebody who's the real guy. And that's just us.
Well, this whole thing is just making me laugh, the dynamics here. And finally, Jerry takes charge because it looks like nobody else is going to. And he says, au revoir. I'm like, bye-bye, Chachi. We're leaving.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, Gilbert's concerned face is something else. Hey, this actor is so good. So Gilbert leaves, and here's Anne. A beat-up Jerry. No money for that big black horse. The Gilbert encounter has left her really unbalanced. And then she looks in the pawn shop window as Joe Pesci puts Marilla's brooch in the window next to Matthew's watch, which hasn't sold yet.
I saw that.
That is a lot of emotions for one little time period. My goodness.
I know, it was a lot.
At nighttime, I don't know if some time has passed or if we caught Gilbert right at sundown or if it took this long to walk over there. It's nighttime, or at least evening time, and it is winter. It could be 4:30, you know. Jerry and Anne arrive at Aunt Josephine's, which Jerry thinks is a palace, not a house. And the butler answers the front door. He is obviously thinking these dirt bags should have gone to the back door.
Well, first off, it's nighttime, and these two kids are modestly dressed, and one of them, his face is all bruised and bloody. These are not our type, dear, I'm sure the butler was thinking.
Butlers are often much more snobby than their masters, I think. Mm-hmm. The butler asks who is calling, and Anne, with a big smile, says, Anne of Green Gables, which I really, really appreciated. So anyway, Josephine arrives. Oh, these are my guests, and bustles them in, and I love the way her house looks. So the thing I love about this scene, just in the entryway, which I'm calling the vestibule, it's pretty fancy, the butler scrunches Jerry's hat off his head, like, take your freaking hat off. Like he doesn't hold out his hand to receive the hat. He literally, I don't even know, like, crumples it up off of Jerry's head. It makes me laugh.
Well, it's a kid, you know, you just treat him like your own kid. Take the hat off.
Aunt Josephine is very concerned about Jerry's face. What has happened to you? And she sends him downstairs with the butler for, you know, cleaning and sorting. And Jerry says, good night. I'll see you in the morning. I'm going to sleep in the stable. And Josephine is like, what are you? Of course you're not. There are guest rooms for both of you. And book people will know how important a guest room is to Anne. To Anne, it is like a 4-star hotel suite.
We'll see it in a little bit. But yeah, it's a good guest room.
Well, Jerry's never going to see a guest room again. I'll tell you that right now.
No, probably not.
If guest rooms are held out for the most prized of guests, I think this is his one shot. Over dinner, Anne tells Josephine about their adventure. And Josephine, I mean, justifiably so, worries about the Cuthberts. And she offers her financial assistance. And Anne refuses because, by the transitive property, if Cuthberts won't accept charity, and Anne is a Cuthbert, then Anne cannot accept charity. That's mathematical.
And I love Aunt Josephine's response. It was a very curious,
She also says, stuff and nonsense.
Yeah.
So Jerry is stuffing his face, and Anne has very good fork technique.
She does. Anne looks very comfortable at that table. Actually, Jerry looks like he's eating, like he's not even aware that it's all fancy. Because he's like, oh, food. I know what to do with this, you know. The food that they were eating was exactly the kind of fare that they would have got at Green Gables, though. It was potatoes and carrots and green beans and a piece of meat. But it was so much fancier because the potatoes were mashed. And the green beans were crisp green, and those carrots were all sliced exactly the same size, and that meat was like medium rare. It wasn't boiled.
Well, and I also wonder, okay, I had a thought while I was watching this. Sometimes, you know how like grandmas might eat one way, but when they have young relative visitors, they might order in the chicken nuggets or get a pizza or whatnot because they're so excited to serve people what they'll probably eat.
Oh, okay.
But they don't have chicken nuggets in the freezer ever. Like, I didn't have ketchup in my house until I had my child. Like, why would a grown-up have, I don't know. I never had ketchup or cereal or any of that stuff, but now I do because I have children. And I wondered if Aunt Josephine's like, now, what do children like to eat?
Oh, wait a second. You didn't have cereal in your house when you were a young single or a early married?
No, I was a low carber.
Oh, man. Our kitchen looked like Seinfeld cabinets with like all the cereal lined up.
Oh, that's funny.
That is funny. Interesting. You know what also? I paused it because I was like, wait a second. You know, they have the fancy glasses out, you know, the two different glasses, the wine and the water.
Yeah.
Jerry's were both filled with water.
Well, was Anne's full of water?
Nope. Only one of Anne's was, and Aunt Josephine had a water and a white wine.
Well, so what you would do if she had white wine, which is kind of wrong with beef, but
I know
if she had a white wine, Jerry's was probably half wine and half water. That's what you do with children. If you're serving it to them at dinner.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's
so
true.
His wine glass was probably half wine and half water.
All right.
And if it's white, you wouldn't be able to tell.
All right. I'll accept that. You're probably right. Because he's French. He's going to have wine with his meals, right?
Probably. We used to, when I was little, we would have it with like spaghetti and that kind of stuff, lasagna and that kind of stuff.
So. Yeah. When my parents had wine, they always gave us a little bit.
Yeah.
So that we would learn how to drink it properly and respect it and not overindulge when we got to college.
How did that work out?
Not so good.
Okay. There you go. Back at Green Gables, Marilla is feeding, or trying to feed, Matthew, who's upset that Anne is off with Jerry. I don't really know why. I think you'd be more upset about I guess he's worried about her safety.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Matthew seems to think he would be better off dead because his life insurance will help them. Matthew is kind of in a weird mental place. And Marilla, of course, thinks this is just crazy. And she says, Anne loves you. Which do you think she would choose, this house or you? And I want to know from somebody, why is the Marilla and John Blythe flashback music playing? So let me say that sentence again. Which do you think she would choose, this house or you? And I'm asking, did Marilla choose this house over John Blythe? And I think so. Or why would that music be playing?
Oh, wow. That was a good get. I never would have thought to pick up on that. Well, that is very interesting.
Well, my. So Marilla tries to set him straight. I hope it works out. She's very firm with, you know, your family loves you. Back at Aunt Josephine's, it's nighttime and Jerry is in bed and he is so scared. His little eyes are so big and he hears a little owl and the room is so big and he creeps into the hallway and into Anne's room and he says, Anne, I've never slept alone. I don't have my own bedroom at home. Can I sleep here? And of course, of course, Anne lets him in. He's so cute. Big boys have scared feelings too. I love it. So she lets him in without a second thought and he crawls into the covers. Kind of funny. What are you doing? She says. And he's like, oh, well, this is the way we sleep. I don't kick my sisters. And she says, you better not. But what I think that means is, oh, well, you're my sister and I'm not going to kick you. Like, you're family to me.
That's exactly how I heard it. I'm like, oh, it's brothers and sisters again. Yeah. Did you notice how they lit that room?
I didn't.
Anne reached over to the nightstand and flipped on an electric lamp.
Ooh, Aunt Josephine's fancy.
Electricity came to PEI in 1885 and they started in the big city. So she would have had it. Right?
Yeah. Well, did I tell you that my house has still in the walls because nobody's taken it out, was piped for gas.
Oh.
And at one point we had light fixtures that said stamped in the metal, do not blow out illuminated gas.
Oh, did they snap on?
Well, I didn't own the house then, so I don't know. It's been, you know, retrofitted for electricity. all the house is wired through the dumbwaiter shaft.
Oh my goodness, which probably made sense at the time. Oh, just use this. It's a big tube. That's too bad.
I'm sure it saved a lot of time. I mean, I still have, I guess if I had a laundry room in the basement, you could just fling everything down the dumbwaiter shaft, but it's inconvenient.
Yeah.
To the kitchen.
Well, then maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was a gas light, but.
No, I didn't notice. I'm sorry. I didn't notice.
No. I'm not saying that now. No, I'm just questioning it though. Okay, I could have sworn it was electric. Snapped it on. There was gas. There was oil lamps out in the hallway, like two of them on a piece of lovely furniture that when Jerry came out, then that kind of illuminated the hallway. But in Anne's room, she snapped on a light. I don't know how gas lights go on. So maybe it was.
Or if you have to light them.
I didn't go that far. I was convinced it was electricity.
No, you could be right, because I would be almost sure you had to hand light the gas lights. You turn on the gas and then light it, because why else would they warn you not to blow it out, because the gas would still be going.
Oh, good point.
So
okay.
To light it, you wouldn't have a pilot light on it. So if it does go right on, it would have to be electricity. I think you're right.
Okay.
So Anne looks down at Jerry, and it's obvious by her face that she will miss him dreadfully. And she says, "Everything will be all right." There's her optimism leaking out again. The next morning, Anne and Jerry are getting ready to leave. And Anne says very politely, "Thank you for providing such a lovely port in the storm." And Aunt Josephine gives Anne a parting gift. "A book by George Eliot. I haven't heard of him," says Anne. And Aunt Josephine is very happy to tell Anne, "George Eliot is a woman." So Anne is delighted to hear that it's a woman and says, "Oh, what nom de plume." And Josephine answers, "If you do write a book someday, I pray you don't need one." So that's a little nod to feminism.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you, other female writers were, of course, writing under their own names by now. But traditionally, to avoid that inevitable judgment and dismissal of their work, women often wrote under a male pen name or as Jane Austen did, a lady, or mm-hmm. anonymous, or initials. Mm-hmm. J.K. Rowling, I might say. I'm sorry to say, same principle. Didn't want the hassle of Joanne being judged for being Joanne. So it took away the gender of the author. You've got the Brontes, who started out as men. You've got Louisa May Alcott, who, did you know, she wrote under the name A.M. Barnard?
How about that?
And George Sand, who was also a woman. So it's an unfortunate thing that women had to contend with and maybe still do.
I think one of the things about George Eliot was that she didn't write like a, quote, woman writer. She wasn't writing these happy ending stories necessarily. She didn't think that that's how she was supposed to write. That was not her ending. That was not her style. So if she wrote as a man, it would be accepted that, you know, it wasn't a guaranteed happy ending.
Josephine has another gift. It is ostensibly a gift to Jerry. "I'm offering you a job at fair wages that happens to be located at Green Gables. Do you accept?" And he does accept, which makes Anne so happy. And I have to say, I was distracted by the bag of coins trope. It is such a funny thing that only happens in movies. Everyone always agrees to whatever it is without looking in the bag, which could be full of washers. I would be astonished if they didn't have this at TV Tropes. But they give everything a funny name, and there's a whole bunch of money tropes, and I couldn't really find it upon a cursory inspection. So if you guys find out what the mysterious bag of money trope is, you could probably name 50 movies where somebody, usually on a horse, throws a peasant some clinking velvet bag and they never look in it.
Aunt Josephine just puts her hand out and Rawlings just dumps his coin bag in her hand.
Yep.
All he said is merci. And she said, good life.
Like, I hope you're not going to be invited back to a guest room. I hope that was awesome for you. Back at Green Gables, it's the morning time. For once, there's no rooster. Maybe roosters are too cheerful. Maybe we've had to eat all the roosters. I really don't know.
They faded him out a couple episodes ago.
Oh, there you go.
I was on Rooster Patrol.
So Marilla is getting, we can pretty safely assume it's the chamber pot. She's got that classic cloth folded over the top to prevent splashing. Anyway, she tells Matthew that he hopes he's had a change of heart since the night before and that Anne is coming home and will be happy to see him. And she refers to past troubles they've weathered together. So we're referring again, you of all people should know, we've been through too much for you to let go now. If you think about it, Matthew would have been better off physically had Anne been a boy in the first place and may not have been in this pickle at all, but he would not have been better emotionally, and neither would Marilla have. I don't think they wouldn't have been as close of a family.
No.
So there's an irony to that situation that really appeals to me, I think.
I agree with all that.
Now, I do not like this whole sequence that follows. No, I do not.
Okay, wait, I'm going to stop you because the next thing that I have written on my notes is Matt's feet, Matt's bare feet. Ah, Beckett.
Oh, that's not what I don't like. I don't like the whole concept. So we're going back and forth.
Oh, okay.
We're going back and forth. It's Marilla in the barn and then Matthew in his nightdress and his, you know, walking through, staggering through, I might say, with his bare feet in the house. He's going somewhere. Where is he going? He's on a mission. She's getting ready to feed the livestock. She's doing all of his chores outside. And he's slowly making his way to the parlor, to the cabinet that used to have Katie Maurice in it, I think.
No. It's nope. The one that had the books.
The one that had the books in it. You know, she is feeding the horses and spreading the hay, and he is finding his bullets and finding his gun, and a carriage comes up, and it is a lady dressed very fancily who knocks on the door. And Matthew tries to get the gun put away before this person comes in the house, and the lady opens the door and says, hello, because she kind of hears fumbling, but no answer, and she peeks around the corner, and it is Miss Jeanie. And they meet eye to eye, and Matthew collapses. And I have to tell you, we know that old Matthew never ever reads his paperwork. And his life insurance policy probably has a clause that won't pay for suicide. So this whole endeavor was redonk. You know what I'm saying? Also, if Michael did commit suicide, like our theory, like we think, this is literally the cruelest thing he could possibly do to Marilla.
Right. No, I agree. But he's not in his right mind. I mean, he is in a depression. His body has crapped out on him. He doesn't know how much longer he's going to be a burden to his family. He's always been the provider, always been the head of the family. His brain isn't functioning the way that you and I would think of his brain to function, if that makes sense. Like, if it was modern times, they'd have him on lorazepam or something, you know, to help him with the depression that is a result of his heart attack.
Anyway, I hate that whole scenario. I am fine with going off book, I'm telling you right now, but that was unnecessary. Anyway, so you can see the anger in my voice. I know,
I hear it. No, you have some very valid points. I agree. They are very valid.
So the two women, Jeanie and Marilla, who has come in from the barn, they get him off the floor. And Marilla's face, when she looks back at the spilled bullets on the floor, what the heck? She is so shocked. And I know the second Matthew gets in that bed, she's moving that gun later. I'm telling you right now, he is never going to be able to find that gun again. Mm-mm. I don't know if it's going to be in the flour bin or down the well, but it is never making another appearance. So Jeanie and Matthew upstairs, while Marilla's dealing with the gun, is my theory. They're talking upstairs about how he knows the impact of an untimely death. You know, that's a little bit of a hint again. Jeanie says, you of all people know the impact of an untimely death and how your loss would affect Anne.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, that seals the whole suicide of Michael storyline for me.
Are they writing it in neon? I mean, are they?
I know. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, like, and you know what else? If they're going to go so far off the book, then I demand that Jeanie and Matthew get married in the next season.
Oh, yeah, me too. I'm with you. Totally. 1,000%.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, he says, don't ever get old. And she laughs and says, too late for that.
I know. It was so cute. And she was so tender with him, you know, when he was laying in bed and she was feeding him the water, and it was so sweet.
So Anne and Jerry are arriving back at Green Gables, and Marilla is so mad at Matthew for what he did, and she is just beside herself. She is crying, and of course he explains himself. I didn't want to be a burden, and I don't know. How could you even think it? She says, and he says, I won't leave you. I won't leave you and Anne. And then he Amina very humbly says, "Will you forgive me? Forgive me." And I started crying at that point.
Me too.
So we have a photo moment again when Anne sees the house, just her happy face to see her home. And of course, I imagined what that face might crumple into had Matthew been successful. That is not very fair. So Anne comes in and runs, of course, right to Matthew, just like Marilla said, just like Jeannie said. And she said, "Well, you are a sight for sore eyes, Mr. Cuthbert."
I know.
Isn't that cute?
It is. It's exactly what they said. This is, I really believe him here, because when he was about to kill himself, the love of his life appeared in his living room.
Jeannie saved his life.
Yeah. Oh, they totally have to get married. Yes. So he has to recuperate from this heart attack and never have another one.
Well, if we're going to be somewhat book accurate, if we're going to pick and choose, he's got a few more years, right?
That's true. Yes. But it would also leave Marilla with a sister-in-law.
Oh, complications.
I know. Well, not our problem. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
Not our problem. I love that. Later that night, Marilla is sitting downstairs counting all the money from their assorted endeavors, cows and pawnbrokers and silver-backed hairbrushes and whatnot. And Anne, while she's looking through her new book, finds money from Josephine. It's in the book, and it's wrapped up with a note that says, "Love isn't charity." Mm-hmm. "We will not be pitied," says Marilla. And then Anne explains, "I would give my last bit of strength or my last dollar to help a friend." And then she says, "Sometimes you just have to let people love you, Marilla." And I cried again.
I did too. This was my favorite line, especially since they paired it with the "love isn't charity" line together. That's my favorite. There's nothing else in this whole episode that made me teary-eyed and as those two lines together.
But even with the money from Aunt Josephine, they have still fallen short. They're adding it up and they just can't make the numbers work. And Anne says they have 3 weeks until the end of December and comes up with a plan. What is this plan? She says she has something else she can sell. And so we see what she can sell, which is her labor. She shows up at some doorways offering holiday cleaning services. And do people hire her because they need help or to help out the Cuthberts? I just don't know.
I think it's a combination of both, because I can't imagine that everybody knows the Cuthberts.
Ah.
And she had a very professional door pitch, I have to say.
And she has her old carpet bag.
I know. Brought back to use. That was fantastic. She says that she, for a small wage, she can do a thorough cleaning for the holiday. What busy homemaker wouldn't want that? I want it right now too. Yeah. She can dust, she can sweep, she can scrub floors, and there's happy montage music, and she starts doing just that.
So the whole montage does go on. Jerry is whittling, I think, mm-hmm. And Marilla gets a letter at the post office that she immediately writes back to, blocking the window. I hope there's not a line. Anne and Jerry walking through a field, dragging a Christmas tree at Green Gables, and Matthew's waving at them from his window. Anne is polishing silver. So where did that silver come from? I don't know.
She's at someone's house. It's part of her cleaning duties.
Oh, I got it. Okay. I was confused. Yeah. Like, well, I thought that Joe Pesci had all the silver, but okay. Yeah. Marilla's getting another letter that makes her look happy. And so the whole time over all this montage, there is a quote from George Eliot, and we now have confirmed what book it is. It is Middlemarch. And the quote is as follows. "When a tender affection has been storing itself in us through many of our years, the idea that we could accept any exchange for it seems to be a cheapening of our lives. And we can set a watch over our affections and our constancy as we can over other treasures." Which is a quote from a character named Mary Garth, who is super intelligent and is thought to be very plain in the Book of Middlemarch. And I am here to tell you that I sense a passing of the torch from Jane Eyre to Mary Garth for season 2's show titles.
Yep, I put that in my cliffhanger section at the end. Yep, I completely agree with you.
So I'm a little... Okay, so we do have a problem in that Mary Garth... Mary Garth's character was said to be, she neither tried to create illusions nor indulged in them for her own behalf. That's wrong. She does take care of an older male relative. She might have to go teach due to a little bit of impoverishness. So we've got that. She has a long-term sort of unrealized love. So there's that. But get this. Critics think that Mary Garth, of all of George Eliot's characters, is the closest to a biographical sketch of her author. So, Maud and Anne equals Mary and George Eliot. Mary and Mary. It's confusing.
Okay. Interesting. Is this the one where it's a bad marriage at the end?
Well, not Mary Garth's marriage. There's a marriage that I don't like. There's a character named Dorothea. I don't know how long ago it's been since you've read it, but there's a character named Dorothea Brooke who marries a man that's a lot older than her because she thinks, among other things, that he is going to allow her to help with his work. And of course, he's a traditionalist and basically cuts her out of all that. And the reason she married him was she sensed an equal marriage where she could participate in his intellectual endeavors. And that was a very big disappointment.
Yeah, I probably didn't actually read it. I probably cliff noted it in high school. So that's why I'm like, oh, I read this book. And then I'm like, maybe not. I know. I was not a great student sometimes.
So yeah, Dorothea Brooke is, I don't know, what is she considered to be? The smart one, and what is her name? Rosamond is the pretty one, and Mary Garth is the workhorse, kind of. Although, okay. I think she's more intelligent than any of the rest of them put together.
All right. So we're going to have to add that to our reading challenge list.
Evidently. Yes, indeed. At Green Gables, Anne is reading to Matthew and suddenly stops and looks at him, and she says, "We're rich, aren't we, Matthew?" They are. They're rich in love. And stringing cranberries is going to take him forever, by the way.
His hand was just shaking. It looked like busy work, actually. You want to do something, Matthew? String these cranberries.
That is going to take a million years. Well, she's using some paper snowflakes, and Jerry shows up with a Merry Christmas present for them. It's a silver star for the tree. And
that's what he was whittling in the barn.
I know. I like that. I hope that Amy McNulty got to keep that brown sweater. It suits her very well.
Yeah, it does.
It's the night of the pageant at the school, and kids are singing "Angels We Have Heard on High," and the town is passing a basket for donations.
I like the that all the girls in the pageant were all wearing white with red scarves. They had like matching outfits on with the boiled wool capelets and scarves. And then there's Moody holding that tin star, like a cool punch tin star. It was cool. It was like double star. I don't know. Here, you hold this. And then there's a shepherd's hook in there, too. Somebody's like, take that. That looks Christmassy.
And then we see Anne and Matthew and Marilla at Green Gables. They're sitting around the fire. Marilla has good news. They're taking in boarders, and they hope they can now keep Green Gables. I noticed that there were lighted candles on the tree. These people and the fire hazards don't stop. Well, we see the carolers from before have started to sing outside. It's Rachel and Diana and Ruby. And is Charlie back?
I think I saw Charlie.
Where's he been this whole time? And Moody's definitely there. And they are finishing up "Angels We've Heard on High." And the Cuthberts come out to watch them from the porch with the lamps in their hand, right? It's very picturesque. And it hope is just all around in and the optimism, and I got a little teary, even though it was kind of a happy cry this time. I'm a mess this time. So daytime, Matthew and Anne are taking a very slow walk around Green Gables, and Anne is very excited about the upcoming year. She says, "It's a new year, just bursting with possibilities. The last one was quite an adventure." To which I say, you don't say, really.
We just spent 8 hours watching your last year.
And I had another Titanic flashback here to Leo DiCaprio's character at the dinner table that said, "Last week I was sleeping under a bridge, and now I'm on the finest ship in the world drinking champagne with you fine people." It's like, you never know what a little time will bring you. So at supper time, there is a strange guy at the table. My, doesn't he look familiar? But then he says, "I wonder where that other fella is that you said you were expecting." So they are pretending not to know each other. Mm-hmm. It's one of the robbers.
Yeah.
Which is the part I don't like. I know you didn't like Gilbert and Anne meeting in a commercial street in the big town, but I don't like these odds. Like, oh, of course these are the guys that answer her ad. I don't think so.
No, I'm with you on that one, too. Totally.
Well, whatever. The handsomer of the two guys with floppy hair is at the door and answers the door, doesn't recognize him. No reason she should. No reason she should. You'll notice Jerry's not home yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably season two. There is a photo moment, again, of Anne looking happy. At the end, all you see is her happy face, like, okay, the income has arrived and Green Gables is saved. It's a little bit of a relieved look, and then it's over.
That's it. It was the Anne shot, and then they were done.
So what do you think of that ending?
Well, I thought there was a lot of cliffhangers, and I'm a little nervous about it. I was like, wow, how many were there? I listed all the cliffhangers that are going on here. You know, what's going to happen when Jerry sees the new boarders? What exactly is their scam? Because the Cuthberts just sold all their valuables, right?
Jokes on them.
I know. So will the Cuthberts be able to pay their loan? There's the whole dangling relationship of Gilbert. What's he going to do? Is he going to come home? Is he going to do the traveling? You know, they've already gone so far off of book Gilbert and Anne's relationship. They didn't talk for, 4 years?
Right.
So, yeah. So that's just up in the air. Who knows? Matthew's health. And is it Matthew and Jeannie sitting in a tree? And when is someone going to punch Josie Pye in the face? Okay. And then, of course, the big cliffhanger is, if there is a season, are they going to shoot titles from Middlemarch? Is one of the questions I had.
I would love it if they did, because wouldn't it be awesome to be right about something that far in advance?
It would be. Okay. So here's my real concern.
Okay.
I think I've talked about Sense8 before. It's another Netflix show.
Netflix?
Another Netflix. Yeah. Netflix, of course. I think I've talked about...
I am now officially calling it Netflix.
Oh, how can I not? Okay. They had all the actors signed for season 3, and then they canceled it. Like, it's done. This show is so amazing. It's shot globally. There's an international cast. It's science fiction. It is so good. But then I read this quote from the CEO and founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings. Quote, "Our hit ratio is too high right now. I'm always pushing the content team. We have to take more risk. You have to try more crazy things because we should have a higher cancel rate overall." So essentially he's saying Netflix needs to cancel more shows to make room for more great shows that are on the horizon.
I don't know if a Breaking Bad remix of Anne of Green Gables is not risky. I don't know what is.
Well, that's the point. He's like, they're doing risky shows, but we can do riskier ones. They canceled Sense8. That's a big deal. I know you never watched it, but it was so good. And boom, canceled.
Well, I don't know. I hope there's a season 2. We haven't had Miss Stacy. We haven't had the famous Lady of the Lake incident, though we did get a reference to it. We have not had the liniment cake or the new preacher's wife yet. We have not had the haunted forest. There are a lot of very dramatic events we could still have.
Yeah.
Even before Anne grows up. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a lot of things. And book accuracy is near zero. And I'm trying to think. Obviously, Matthew lived a lot longer in the books, but wasn't it Marilla's eyesight going, which made them possibly have to sell Green Gables?
Yeah, but I believe that was after Matthew died.
Oh, yeah, it was way later. Way later.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just trying to think what the right story was, or what the original story was.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. I didn't mind the robbery. I mean, I minded. I didn't want to see little Montaz beaten up. Certainly. I didn't mind the incidents of the robbery. What I minded was those robbers becoming an integral part of the plot now. I didn't like that at all.
No, they were too home alone for me.
Well, and just say no to nefarious overconvenience. Come on now.
Yeah.
We could have two random other guys and that wouldn't have been as bad.
It could have been two other guys sitting in the same pub.
We don't have to know even who they are.
Yeah, but maybe the Jerry connection. Is
critical. Sure. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. So how many glasses of raspberry cordial would you give this?
I said 8 because there were two very, very bad things. The suicide plot was bad to me. and the bad guy's reappearance was, those two things were so bad that they really took off a big chunk. But there's so much good. The Jerry and Anne thing, the Miss Jeannie reappearance, the realism of the financial woes, I found very, not entertaining because I'm not a sicko, but, you know, interesting. Mm-hmm. I liked watching them work through that. I liked the fact that it was the women that handled it, Marilla and Anne, Miss Josephine and Rachel Lynde, are the women that handled it. The men in the case, Matthew's out of it, and the other man in the case got kicked out too because he got beat up and left in an alley. So the two men folk were really of no help, and it was the ladies that pulled it together. And I don't know if everyone's going to really get that, that it was just a feminine endeavor to save the farm.
Yeah, I totally got it, which is why I gave it a 9.8.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, since I had already taken the points off on the last episode, I thought that there was enough cliffhangers for a second season, enough things, storylines they could start to tie up then. But I really wasn't keen on those Home Alone-esque robbers, that right. storyline. The feminist angle, all the women solving the problem that they had, I love that. So my snack, I thought, okay, it's the last episode. I should do the last recipe in the book, right? So the last recipe is caramel pudding sauce. All right, that's good. You're supposed to put it over Marilla's plum pudding, but did I have the ingredients for plum pudding? I did not. So I asked my daughter, who loves to bake, if she could make chocolate goblins food cake instead of angel food cake. Anyway, so it's a chocolate cake. Shouldn't be too hard. Well, it didn't come out of the pan right. So I had like crumbled cake instead of, it was tasty and it was very moist, but it was in pieces. So I thought back to Julia Child and I said, okay, well, let's look at this. We'll reimagine it. I crumbled it into the bottom of a springform pan and then I put the caramel sauce on top of it. And then I put a half gallon of vanilla ice cream on top of that, chocolate chips on top of the whole thing. And now I have a most delicious ice cream cake.
See, you're having all the ingredients for ice cream cake baffles me too. So,
oh, it's summertime. We always have ice cream in the summertime.
In the summertime, we purposely don't have ice cream in the house.
So you can go walk out and get it?
Because if you have ice cream in the house, you just eat it.
Yeah. And so your problem there is what? Yeah,
no, I think you got to determine, I wish for ice cream. Do I wish for it enough to get in the car and or walk down the trail to get some? And if you're like, then the answer is no.
The only ice cream we can walk down a trail for is McDonald's. And that's not really ice cream. I don't think. Nope. Sorry. It's our thing. We love ice cream. When we go on vacation, we have it every single day.
I love that.
My dad did it for us when we were on vacation, and I do it for my kids.
Well, we have alcoholic beverages every day. So obviously we are darker.
Do you have any closing remarks?
I don't have any closing remarks except for, and I almost hate to, if you want season two, I don't know who has the power, but I will just mention Moira Wally Beckett's Twitter account is at Yo Wally B. YoWallyB. Do with that what you will.
This has been really fun. I've really enjoyed doing this.
I really have too. And should there be a season two, we will be back. Don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. How could we not be?
My son tried to watch a show with me once when I was trying to make notes. And he's like, you're driving me insane with all this stopping and looking things up and wondering how old the so-and-so is and freeze framing on stuff. He's like, is this how you always watch TV? And of course, my response is, I never even get the remote control most of the time. I'm only watching this now because it's for work.
Yeah, I don't usually get the big TV either. We watched it. I did anyway, flat out binged it at the beginning and then went back. But yeah, that stopping thing, that would have driven my family crazy. This was a little bit more work than I had expected. I have to say that too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I just thought, it'd be fine. We'll just come on, jot a few notes. But no, being who we are, it's like that little stove we saw in the general store. It's like, what is that stove? What does it do? Why do they have it out there? You have to fall into all these rabbit holes, which in retrospect was fun. I was a little surprised.
Well, that is all we have for season one of Netflix's Anne with an E. Thank you so much for coming on this journey. If you know a friend in real life who liked that show but hasn't yet heard of us, please direct them our way. We would really appreciate that. We will be back with our usual format of historical biography on our very next episode. Thanks for listening.
Bye. I can't hear you unless I have my earbuds in. I can't have my earbuds in or I can't get very far.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Il était un berger, un petit petit bon. Il était un berger qui gardait ses boutons. She didn't hear me.
Okay.
But she would like it if she heard it.
Oh, it's so cute in here.
Okay, how's that?